Preach Galt's harp. Right. Would you like to turn to the Gospel of Mark? And we're looking at Mark chapter 9. Mountaintop Experiences is what I've entitled this morning. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there he appeared, there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He didn't know what to say, they were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and enveloped them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my son whom I love, listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they'd seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. Last week on a radio program I was listening to, there was a fleeting mention of Michael Jackson, the iconic pop idol. When I heard it, there was triggered one of those memories that we can sometimes get, and it got me thinking about him. And I can quite clearly remember when Michael Jackson died. It was in June 2009. And Joan and I were on holiday in Scotland when the news broke and the radio and TV stations were immediately taken over by tributes to this fallen idol. As part of this media frenzy, there was a TV program that was called something like The Transformation of Michael Jackson. We were shown a series of pictures of his face from when he was a child, a young man, and right up to the time of his passing. And it would dramatically demonstrated the way his face had been transformed by plastic surgery over the previous 10 or 15 years. But no matter how much the outward appearance had changed, he still remained the same Michael Jackson, with the same insecurities and the same problems. For the essential Michael Jackson still remained hidden underneath the much modified exterior. And it seems that in our present world there's a great fascination with plastic surgery. There are many stars of entertainment and other high-profile people who subject themselves not only to these procedures in the cause of so-called beauty. But it's not only the rich and the famous. For many ordinary people also undergo cosmetic surgery and Botox injections in order to change their appearance. So much so that sometimes the real person is undetectable. But the problem with all these makeovers is that although the outward appearance is changed, the inner person, the essential nature, remains just the same. It's not the outward appearance that defines us, it's the inward person that we are. Jesus said in Luke 6, verse 45, well, if I can get myself right, what did I do there? He said, "The good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and the evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. For out of the overflow of his heart, his mouth speaks." In our text this morning, we read about an occasion when, for a brief time, Jesus was physically transformed, right before the eyes of Peter, James, and John. But Jesus wasn't transformed into someone or something unlike himself. He wasn't transformed into something artificial or different to whom he really was. Just the opposite. When Jesus was transformed, his true nature shone through. Sometimes people will experience what they may refer to as really extraordinary events, and they'll often call them mountaintop experiences. Well, that's what happened to Peter and John that day. It was the ultimate mountaintop experience. Jesus led Peter, James, and John up a high mountain. And he was transformed, glorified, transfigured before them. His clothes turned a dazzling white, whiter than any bleach could ever get them. And then Elijah appeared, the great prophet. And Moses appeared, the lawgiver. And then Elijah and Moses were gone, leaving only Jesus. The law was gone. The prophets were gone. Only Jesus is now left, the pinnacle of God's salvation. All of a sudden there is, for Peter, James and John, this wonderful, dazzling moment where Jesus, the humble carpenter's son, is revealed in his great glory and splendor. And surely this is a mountaintop experience above any other. So I was thinking about this passage this week and preparing the word. I had a tendency to want to come down off the mountain. I wanted to talk about how Peter wanted them to build three dwelling places up on that mountain and just stay there. I wanted to point out that Peter was wrong yet again, because at some time we've got to come down off the mountain and live out our life down here below as a follower of a Christ in the world. I wanted to talk about how mountaintop experiences can't last, how you've got to come down to the valley below. I still want to talk about them, but first I want us to just linger on the mountain for a little while longer. Because sometimes we all just need to have a little mountaintop experience with Jesus. Because here was Jesus transformed upon a mountaintop so that he shone as bright as the sun, and with him are the great Moses and the great Elijah. And we can't just go on about our lives as if these things have never happened, as if they never can or never will happen. We can't just pass over this part about the overwhelming brightness of Jesus' appearance and the fact that Peter, James and John saw Moses and Elijah talking and heard the voice from heaven. Before we talk about what it means to follow Christ in the valley below, we need to spend a little time on the mountaintop. We don't want to be accused of just having our heads in the clouds as Christians. We don't want to be accused of basing our faith on emotionalism. But really, I don't think that we're in any danger of that. We're rational, well-educated people. But today's text is a good reminder that our faith is more than a rational academic subject. At least part of our faith is about the yearning to see God and experience his power. It's about being touched by the Spirit and being moved by the voice of the Lord whispering in our ears. Our faith is so rich, our God is so good, that it makes no sense at all to limit what is possible for us to the dry bones of everyday, humdrum, routine, rational life. Our God is about entertaining angels. It's about seeing visions of a new heaven and a new earth. It's about being refreshed by God. It's about experiencing God in ways that stretch our imagination. I heard about a little 12-year-old boy who came from a very poor country family, and he'd never, ever seen a circus. And one day he saw a poster that the circus was coming to town, and he ran home and asked, "Dad, Mom, can I go?" Well, the family was quite poor, but their father sensed how important it was for the boy, so he said, "If you do all your jobs ahead of time, I'll see that you have the money to go." So Saturday morning, the jobs were done, and the boy stood ready in his best clothes at the breakfast table, and his father gave him a £5 note, the most money the boy had ever seen at one time. After the usual cautions about being careful, the boy was sent on his way. And he was so excited that his feet barely touched the ground all the way to the town. And when he got there, he saw the people were lining the streets, and he worked his way through the crowd until he could see what was going on. And there in the distance approached the circus parade, the grandest thing you've ever seen. The exotic animals in cages and bands and midgets, acrobats, and all that goes on to make up a great circus. And after everything had passed, where they were standing, a circus clown came along with the floppy shoes and baggy pants and a brightly painted face, bringing up the rear with a bucket and collecting donations. And as the clown passed by where he was standing, the boy reached into his pocket and got out the precious £5 note. Handing the money to the clown, the boy turned round and went home. He never actually saw the circus itself. And the mistake that the boy made is the same mistake we can all make in our spiritual lives. We can end up for settling for less than the real thing, for the part instead of for the whole, because either we don't believe in what God can do, or because we've forgotten what it's like to be truly and wonderfully touched by the glory of God. Have you forgotten what it's like to experience the full glory of God's presence? Do you really believe that God can do something beyond the limits of your imagination? If your whole Christian experience consists of some good friends, a few Bible studies, and some good deeds now and again, you might be seeing the parade, but you've missed the circus. And the circus is really something to see. We do need those mountaintop experiences every now and then, when God pulls back the curtain between today and eternity and gives us a peek, when we get a glimpse of glory. We need that, and it's good. The wonderful encounters we're told about in the Bible, the experience of God that recorded there, are still needed today, and they still occur today. I can remember the time when Joan had such an experience. We'd not been saved all that long when we went to a weekend conference in North Yorkshire. The Saturday afternoon we had some free time and we went to Ripon for the afternoon. And while we were there we went into the cathedral. And as we strolled around this magnificent building, Joan stopped for a few moments gazing at a stained glass window. The afternoon sun was shining brightly through the stained glass, and in that moment Joan saw something of the glory of God. For just a short time she was transfixed by the vision that she had. I only saw a stained glass window, but Joan saw something of the glory of God. Some catch sight of the glory of God in the things around them. Some glimpse him during a close encounter with death. Some meet him in a special way during a period of suffering. Others while they're praying at some special meeting or gathering or worship or during a song. But Joan saw it in that moment when God revealed himself in that window. On that mountaintop, Peter, recognizing that this was a special moment as he saw Jesus in dazzling brightness, flanked by Moses and Elijah, makes a suggestion. He says, "Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. Let's put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." And Mark then states the obvious. Peter didn't really know what to say. They were terrified. But I think I can understand what Peter was trying to do. He'd been totally confused all along by Jesus. The story of Jesus' transfiguration follows immediately after Jesus' first prediction of his death and resurrection. And in chapter 8, immediately before this glorious scene, is that famous moment when Peter rebuked Jesus for saying his journey would lead to suffering and death. And Jesus rebuked Peter, saying, "Get thee behind me, Satan." And then shortly after that, Peter is with Jesus on the mountaintop in all his glory. And I imagine that Peter can be thinking, this is what it's supposed to be like when the Messiah comes. He's not going to suffer and be killed. He's coming in glory and power. Just look at this. Finally, Peter had found a place where he felt good and comfortable with Jesus. So he suggests that they build some shelters and stay for a while. That's when we come back to the everyday. The transfiguration was only meant to last a moment. It was a glimpse of the future, but the future had yet to come. They had to go back down from the mountain, back down into the valley, where there were sick people to be healed, disputes among the disciples to settle, and lots more work to be done. And as Jesus had promised, there would be suffering and death. Peter wanted to fix that transfiguring mountaintop moment in concrete. And so do we. But we can't. What the disciples needed to realize was that Jesus is both the Son of God, powerful agent of transformation, subject with dazzling glory. But he is also the Son of Man, and he'll be betrayed and persecuted and crucified. Peter, like many Christians throughout the life of the church, wants to have the glory without the sacrifice, the mountaintop without the valley. The disciples, like some of us, always thought that where the Messiah is, there is no misery. So Peter would reject Jesus' prediction of his death and want to build a house on the mountain of glory. Here is the real glory now, Peter might say, without suffering, without death. But it's a mistake to think that where the Messiah is, there's no misery. The real point is the exact opposite. Where there is misery, that is where the Messiah is. I think we can all identify with Peter and the disciples here. It's not easy for us to resist the idea of a no problem, all glory, all the time gospel. To look for a life of just laying back with nothing much to do and letting the world go by, knowing that we're safe, so there's really nothing to worry about. We just go to church, have a good worship time, pray a bit, and then go back home. Back to the cozy, laid-back life that we would all enjoy. Wouldn't it be nice to just pitch a tent and stay a while in that kind of life? But we need to remember that you don't get glorious mountaintop experiences for free. You don't get glory without sacrifice. You can't just receive the good stuff without also giving of yourself in thousands of ways. Over and over again, the gospel lifts up both sides of Jesus' identity, relentlessly recalling that suffering will lead to triumph. Triumph cannot be had without the price of the cross. For Peter and James and John, the mountain of transfiguration was a glorious, true mountaintop experience, and we all need that. For sure we do. But for Jesus, and for all of us who follow after him, it needs to be understood that there is one more mountaintop experience ahead, one more mountain to climb, a hill called Calvary. The Mount of Transfiguration, the Mount of Calvary, glory and sacrifice, twin peaks. We cannot have one without the other.